I'd like to read to you from the latest vision this morning. I'm very fortunate that Swami Satchitananda has started sending my copies of the vision to me by airmail, so I get them right now instead of 3 months from now. I would recommend this little magazine to any and all of you who are not taking it. It's on a donation basis. You have to get a Chase National Bank draft and make it payable to the managing editor at a managing trustee at Anandashram. And there is nothing but pure truth in here. This I can testify to because it was under the guidance of Swami Ramdas that I attained my final realization. And I know that this man is totally universal in the way that he puts forth the truth. It is absolute truth. This article is entitled, Love is Beauty. When you have discovered the beauty of the divine within you, your entire life becomes beautiful. Beauty expresses itself through your mind, your senses, and your body. Beauty and love go together. They are the supreme attributes of the divine. The instant you behold the divine in all things, great or small, in all beings and creatures on the earth, love light shines in your eyes. Your words pour like the gentle drops of rain. Your acts convey a soothing and healing influence. Verily, whatsoever is thought, said, and done bears the true stamp of beauty. How can you attain the blessing of this supreme love? There is only one condition. You have to mingle your ego with the dust of the feet of your eternal beloved. It is now that your life undergoes a magnificent change. You seem to have passed gloom and darkness and entered into the realm of joy and radiance. In a flash, as it were, the beloved and yourself are realized to be one in essence and substance. In this grand union, as that of the river with the ocean, your life achieves an all-round perfection. You should not forget, love is your goal. This state does not signify either renunciation or attachment. It is neither giving nor receiving. It is simply living in and with love. In fact, in this state, love and life are not different. In this mystic union, you experience an ecstasy which is incomparable. It may be called love madness. Those who are inebriated with love appear to behave strangely, but they are like the stars shining in the dark night. They are the white flowers in the desert of the world, which has not known the beauty of the real life of love. They are the beacons that illumine the hearts of those who grope in darkness and that open their eyes to the glory of love. What a grand ideal to cherish. What a life of inexpressible felicity, purity, freedom, and peace. To be surrounded with light always, to lose yourself into that light, is indeed a wonderful experience. Before this highest ideal, what other ambition can stand? Life is drab, tasteless, and futile if its aim is other than the realization of this beatific state. Those of you who agree with Ramdas in what he has said above will surely lift up your hearts and minds and look to the Supreme Beloved with a longing so intense that the Great Giver may shower the fullness of his grace and transform you all into his image. Beauty, love, and joy be ever yours. I have one of the Gospels by Keith this morning. Then a man whose life now looked back upon itself came unto Jesus and said, Master, wouldst thou tell me what is my future? And the Christ answered, Of thy destiny I may speak, but of thy future that must be spoken from the lips of thy own heart. For thy destiny and the destiny of all men is to love God as he hath first loved thee. The future is but a path thou buildest with the bricks of the day. Seek, therefore, to choose thy path with a heavenly vision and thy destiny with an eternal flame. For for all else is but a shadow searching a form, and a cloud seeking the sky. O ye that have ears to hear, listen, for the destiny of men is to become the love which they have ever been, and to live in the light that God has given to all. But I say to thee, that it is easier for him that seeketh his destiny in darkness than for the one who waiteth until tomorrow's day. For he who desires his heart's fulfillment in the morrow shall wait forever, but he that careth for the day shall bear witness to an eternal future in which life's flower shall never fade. My beloved brother, open thy heart that I may tell thee and make thee to understand. The dream thou dreamest and the destiny thou longeth after are a whole holy presence, for God is destiny's eternal moment, and he waiteth patiently for his children to return unto himself. And he that guideth each bird to its nest and each flower to its field shall not fail to guide thy steps on their heavenly course. Therefore live this moment as thy destiny fulfilled and thy future found, for it is that, and thou art that which thou livest, not that after which thou waitest. Thus I ask thee, was man made for the moment, or the moment for the man? For if thou believest these things I speak are true, then hast thy heart given rise to eternal day. And he that seeketh first God hath become destiny, and hath no further need of an unknown tomorrow. For in him hath the tomorrow dawned, and the kingdom of God birthed its eternal truth. This man is really something in God. I think I'll read this to you now. I've chosen this morning as a subject for my talk, the windows of your soul. It is so important what we not only take into our own consciousness through the windows of our own beings, but what we put in the consciousness of those we bring into the world and of all of the little children that we meet. I've had some questions from parents lately, and instead of making it a part of the sermon, I will read it to you now. Parents can play an important part in helping their children earn good grades in school, says an expert. By far the most important factor in education is the emotional aspect, and this is where parents can make the biggest contribution, by helping the kids deal with their hurts, fears, and anxieties, says Gerald Smuckler. Smuckler, a school psychologist and director of the Jackson Heights Counseling Center in Jackson Heights, New York, had these 16 suggestions for parents. First, make sure your child has a complete physical checkup before school starts, including vision and hearing tests, and then he gets a proper diet, plenty of rest, and regular exercise. Next, avoid showing your children any negative feelings about school you might have, telling them about unpleasant or upsetting school experiences you had, or of your anger at a school system, can have a bad effect on their schoolwork since they will act out those attitudes. Third, aggressiveness is important for learning. Encourage your child to express aggression through healthy outlets, such as sports, and in art activities such as clay molding, which involves cutting, pounding, and hammering. If you put down all aggressiveness as bad, you will interfere with his learning. Fourth, do not force your child to do assignments he finds extremely difficult. Speak to the teacher or guidance counselor about the problem. If your child isn't doing as well as he should, some changes in the teaching method can often help. Listen to your child. Kids are spoken at a lot by teachers, parents, and television. Give your child an opportunity to talk to you. This helps him get things off his chest. Accept his negative feelings, too. If he says he hates math, for example, don't discourage him from expressing this hatred. One way kids can express socially unacceptable feelings is by creating puppet shows. It's okay for the puppet children to do all sorts of unacceptable things, like beating up the teacher or acting disrespectful to the parents. This is a socially legitimate outlet for attitudes which would cause all sorts of problems if shown in other ways. 6, make sure your child is relaxed before he begins his homework. If he's uptight, he won't get much out of it. One technique is simply to have your child talk to you about anything that's upsetting him. Another is physical exercise. 7, set up just a few important rules, such as times to do homework and to play, not doing harmful things to himself or to other people, and rewards for complying. Discuss rewards with your child to determine what is appropriate. Don't nag. Don't compare your child to his brothers and sisters. Accept him as he is. Always encourage your child's strengths to give him an adequate can-do self-concept. If you're stressing only weaknesses, he'll lose self-confidence, and that will definitely interfere with his learning. Except for those few rules, ignore your child's negative actions and emphasize his positive ones. Children, like most people, will act out what they feel you expect. Calling a child a dumbbell makes him think he is one, and he will act like one. 11, do everything possible to make your child feel worthwhile and decent. Schoolwork is only one part of his life. Show appreciation for his value as a person without making him feel he must earn your respect. Number 12, limit punishment, including ridicule and mockery, and reprimand him privately, never before other people. Don't humiliate him. 13, don't demand perfection. Fear of making mistakes will interfere with your child's learning and inhibit his creativity. Trial and error is an important part of learning. If you overemphasize achievement, you can paralyze your child with fear of failure. Join the PTA so you can follow what goes on in school and always be sure your child does his homework. 15, build a positive relationship with your child. Having fun as well as learning is important for growth. Take your child on pure fun excursions, such as to amusement parks or zoos. 16, allow your child to be a child. Make sure he regularly plays with kids his own age. Involvement in organizations such as the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, Boys Club, and Police Athletic League is also helpful. I think that's a very fine article, and it was taken from the Globe newspaper, and perhaps we can get copies of it made for those who want it. Our Bible chapter this morning is St. Matthew, chapter 21, beginning with verse 20. Then came to him the mother of Zebedee's children with her sons, worshipping him and desiring a certain thing of him. And he said unto her, What wilt thou? She saith unto him, Grant that these my two sons may sit, the one on thy right hand and the other on the left, in thy kingdom. But Jesus answered and said, Ye know not what ye ask. Are ye able to drink of the cup that I shall drink of, and to be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? They say unto him, We are able. And he saith unto them, Ye shall drink indeed of my cup, and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them for whom it is prepared of my Father. And when the 10 heard it, they were moved with indignation against the two brethren. But Jesus called them unto him and said, Ye know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them. But it shall not be so among you. But whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister, and to give his life a ransom for many. And as they departed from Jericho, a great multitude followed him. And behold, two blind men sitting by the wayside, when they heard that Jesus passed by, cried out, saying, Have mercy on us, O Lord, thou Son of David. And the multitude rebuked them, because they should hold their peace. But they cried the more, saying, Have mercy on us, O Lord, thou Son of David. And Jesus stood still and called them and said, What will ye that I shall do unto you? They say unto him, Lord, that our eyes may be opened. So Jesus had compassion on them and touched their eyes, and immediately their eyes received sight, and they followed him. We have been taught, I'm sure most of us who have grown up in the Christian faith or whatever faith, that all of these things in the Bible are factual, they are historical. And we think that of all the miracles that Jesus did as being, as pertaining to our physical world or our physical being. Like, for instance, where he has touched the blind men and has opened their eyes. But don't you see, in this case, it says opened their eyes. Now, they already had eyes with which to see. And it is said that the eyes are the windows of the soul. And that if you look into a person's eyes, you can tell exactly what their consciousness in God is. And so it is for the enlightened person. When you come before the guru, before the master, that one can take one look, and they know immediately. But they know not only with these outer physical eyes, but truly with the eyes of the soul. And their eyes is this feeling, this deep knowledge, this Christ consciousness within, that knows all things, because it is the source of all things, and it is that life, that consciousness, that will, that power that is in every single human being the world over without exception. It is the Christ in you. Now, what are the windows of your soul? We think of these eyes, true, because we see with them. But we also have other windows through which we see. We have the window of hearing. We have the window of smelling. We have the window of tasting. And we have the window of touch. And through these five senses, which are truly the windows of our souls, we find in every case that we are taking certain things into our consciousness, and that whatever we take within our consciousness affects our growth or hampers it. It either makes us grow or hampers it, I should say. This is true of each and every one of it, of us. It is going on every moment of our lives. We act and we react to everything around us. Many times we say, think, or do things ourselves, and we think just the next second after, oh my Lord, why did I think, say, or do that? Look what I've gotten myself into now. Everybody has had that at some time or other. And believe me, we get ourselves into a mess sometimes. But it is so important that you learn to control the windows of your soul, the windows of your senses, because they affect your spiritual growth, your spiritual development. It is only when you sit on the top of the mountain peak that you can look at everything equally and know all there is to know, because you have seen, you have experienced everything there is to know on your climb up that mountaintop, because each step of the way you have at some time turned to rest and to look around you to see the vision of that which is before you. But as you grow higher and higher and higher, you can see at a much greater distance. The air becomes more rarefied. And sometimes it's very difficult for people to climb to a great height in the physical sense. But the most wonderful part of it is that there is no limitation to climbing into the mountain of your own being. Now, wherever you are now, that is where you are coming from in your consciousness. That is where you have climbed the mountain to that point of perception, of seeing, of knowing. And because you have climbed only to that distance, you cannot possibly know what it is like at the top of the mountain until you get the rest of the way. No way. It is like the man who was out in the forest and he saw a beautiful tree, and all of a sudden as he stood looking at the tree, saw this beautiful creature on the tree. And he said, "Oh my, isn't that creature beautiful? It was such a beautiful wren." And he went home and told his friend about it. And the friend said, "I too have seen the creature on that tree, but you are wrong. He is green." And another one who was standing by and says, "You are both wrong. I too saw him, and he was yellow." So, but there was a man sitting underneath the tree. And he said, "My friends, you are all right, and you are all wrong," he said, "because that creature is a chameleon." And he said, "He is also blue, he is black, and at times he is totally colorless." And he said, "Only he who has sat under the tree and has seen the chameleon at all times knows what he is." And so it is with the truth, because the truth is that God is all things. He is form, he is formless, and he is beyond both of those things, because they are both words to describe an idea of what God is, and you cannot possibly describe what he is. And that brings us to another tale which will explain just exactly why this is so. There was a man who was told that if he got up before dawn and went to a certain place at a desert, a certain distance from a mountain, that as the dawn came up, he would see his shadow. And if he followed that shadow to the end and dig there, that he would find the treasure. So when the dawn came, there he was in the appointed place in the desert. And he started to dig and to dig and to dig. But he didn't realize that the sun was rising in the heavens and that a shadow was no longer there. All of a sudden, he dug and dug and dug, and he didn't find any treasure, and he stood still. He looked for his shadow, and he couldn't find his shadow. And he realized the great lesson to be learned, that the treasure that he went so to such great lengths to dig for was actually within himself. Actually within himself. That's the only place. This is your treasure house. This is your treasure house. Now, this is the wonderful thing you see about meditation. Now, in our everyday life, we open our eyes in the morning and we see, whether it depends what time of the night or the morning you wake up, you see either darkness or you see the dawn. And so depending on what God has appointed you to do, you either stay in bed and go back to sleep, or you get up and you put your clothes on and go about the day's business, and you think, "Oh, I wish I could stay there just a little bit longer. That bed feels so good." But meditation has entered into the lives of many. We have had prayer for centuries, but we haven't had what we call meditation. And yet, I had somebody who was very orthodox in their thinking tell me that it was a sin to talk about meditation in connection with God and the Christian teachings. And I went to the concordance, and it's a strange thing, but I found the word meditation in the concordance quite a few times. It was in some of the things in the Old Testament and the New Testament. So many times we get preconceived ideas, and they are, believe me, of our own choosing, our own making, or that which we have accepted, which is told in the form of a fairy tale from others, and we have taken as absolute truth. The man who meditates, or the woman who meditates, and truly meditates, gets up early in the morning with joy. The first thought which crosses their consciousness when they come back into the conscious world from this dream sleep, where their bodies have still moved and lived and breathed, and the heart has kept on beating, all the things of the body is kept on with no conscious volition of theirs, is to think of God. "Well, good morning, God. It's a wonderful day, isn't it? I greet you. I feel the power of your love, of your blessing within me. Let this day of my life be dedicated totally to you." That one gets up and does the necessary, and then goes to his meditation blanket and sits there and communes with God. He raises his consciousness and prepares himself for the day to come. And if he is not able to do that on a certain day, he counts that day as lost because something is missing. He hasn't built the foundation for his day that he should have built. And so as he looks out from his windows that day, perhaps all he sees is tiredness, depression, darkness, dissension. Everything goes wrong. Or if it doesn't, at least it's a humdrum day with nothing exciting happening. But the man of God who has established his communion with God the first thing in the morning goes forth with the knowledge of, of God's love. And because he has established that communion within himself, he sees God in every form that walks before him. Did you ever go along the street and actually look into the eyes of the people whom you meet? If you've ever studied character reading or body language, it's a very, very interesting thing to do. And you can tell by the shape of a person's eyes, the size of their eyes, the shape of their nose, their cheekbones, the thinness or thickness of their lips, whether the chin juts out or whether it recedes or whether it's normal. By the motions of the body, you can read that person's whole consciousness, their whole mind. It's very easy, very easy. And as you become acquainted with certain individuals, if you will put that into practice and watch how they act or how they operate under certain circumstances, you will see that what I tell you is true. And you can tell an awful lot about what goes in their mind. And then as you talk to them, as you watch what comes forth from their being, you will be able to verify the truth of your observation. It's very interesting to do that. But the greatest way of knowing is to know from within yourself. This feeling that you have, this is just a little barometer. Right smack in here, it is said that your solar plexus is the second brain of your body. And that brain feels at all times it is a window of your soul. But it is a little higher than the senses because it is a feeling thing which is related to the essence of things. But of course, that essence is the very heart of everything. And what you're observing as you do the body language thing, or watching, there are bird watchers and then there are people watchers. And many people spend much time watching birds and animals and things, and they learn a lot about them. They even learn their language, and they're able to talk to them. But people watching is even more fascinating, because don't forget that people are God's highest creatures, and that there is no God except this I, which is constantly or consciously present in man alone, but which is present in every single atom of creation. So everything that exists has a window, and that is the consciousness within it, the awareness within it. And if you lack that consciousness, that awareness, you are in deep trouble. I have known people who have great difficulty, good people, who have great difficulty in relating, in being aware, of being sensitive to other people, and they go blundering in their own way, and they cause havoc sometimes, or they cause people to feel that they're not interested in them, or they don't like to be around them, and yet these people have so much love, and they need so much love more than anyone else. Do you know that truly, as I've read to you this morning from various things, it is love that makes the world go round. It is the only thing which will heal a broken world. It is the salve that you put on all the wounds that suffering humanity has and which man has put upon himself. When we look at what is happening today of man's inhumanity to man, of the tremendous struggle for power between the forces of good and evil, and this perhaps under spiritual so-called leadership, it is unbelievable. It is unbelievable. You know, we should not go to war. We should cultivate peace. We go to war with the enemies within ourselves, perhaps. And yet we don't It's as Jesus said, we resist not evil. That means that you don't war with it, but that rather you take your attention away from it and place it upon God. And no matter what anybody does to you, you go back and you give them love. You give them attention, because it isn't important what anybody else does to you. It is only important what you are and what you think and what you say and what you do. Because if you're constantly letting your tongue wag, you know, you can cause an awful lot of trouble and dissension. Be still and know that I am God. But when you are not still, speak only the words that will take people into higher consciousness. Teach them things. Speak of the higher sciences, of art, of music, of all of the good things that are happening in the world, if any at the moment. But at least we know that we are trying to make our world a better world with our consciousness only upon God through Christ. And as I've said so many times before, there is such a tremendous army of God's children that are needed. And we are growing and growing and growing. And yet all of the children, all over the world, are God's children. The only thing is, you see, that they are still looking out of the windows of the lower stories. And because they haven't cleaned their windows, an awful lot of dirt and debris, perhaps mud and rain and sleet and snow, have accumulated on the outside. And so they are operating without being able to see clearly. We must not look down upon them. We must just realize that God is in that form too. And that if we, through our own examples, can keep our own windows washed clean, then we will help to make it a cleaner, a brighter, and a better world. And don't forget, the buck stops here, as President Truman had this little motto on his desk. But also, everything starts from here, and it will stop from here. Because when you have gone the full gamut of all that you must go through in order to reach out for God with the complete longing, when you cry for him with your heart, your mind, and your soul, then he will lift you up. He will put you through the necessary experiences to make you realize who and what you are in him. And you will realize that there is no separation, and that no matter where you look, there is God. No matter what he is doing, it is God in that form that is doing this, because there is only one power, one presence, one consciousness in this whole wide world. And we are but parts of that. And we can go up into the mountain of our own beings, and we can indeed see through the windows of our soul, our spiritual windows. That's in the upper story. And if we keep those windows clean and pure, with the consciousness always upon God, those windows will shine brightly. You can always tell when a person has been meditating, when somebody has their full attention upon God, because not only the eyes show with an unearthly brightness, but also the skin glows. The whole being is charged with the power and the presence of God. There's only one will. There is only one power, one presence, one consciousness. Remember this. And you are that. But God, you see, has made this play. The God-realized soul has gone beyond, above duality, gone from, well, even beyond form and formless as it is known, because it is an experience, as I have taught you before. But when he has that experience and then comes back into the bodily consciousness and functions again in a human form, then he again becomes the child, the servant of God. But at all times he knows, I am that I am. But he also knows that he is the child and the servant of God, because in the human sense, he is that part of God, that separate cell, that spark of the infinite spirit of God. But it is the same Father God who is speaking at all times, who is living at all times, who is acting at all times, who is doing everything at all times. As I told you once before, when I asked God what his will for me was, there was deep silence and I cried my heart out because I couldn't get any answer. Finally, his answer came and he said, "Your will is my will," and I had the whole thing back in my lap again. I didn't like that, you see, and I still don't like it from that standpoint when I'm functioning in the human consciousness. Nobody has ever taken my will away from me because my will is the will of God, as is yours. But it is the delusive force which makes us think that there are separate wills. But if I, in my human consciousness, am functioning as a human being, as a separate cell of God's body, thinking of myself as separate from him, then it is my will to do only the will of God. And in that moment of total surrender, there is nothing there but God at any given time. Now that's mind-blowing, perhaps to the intellectual, but it is the truth. It is more than a fact. It is the truth, because there is only one mind. Otherwise, God would not be omniscient. There is only one will. Otherwise, God would not be all-powerful. And when we come to that point, when we are totally ready to throw everything into the ocean, everything that we call ourselves and our own, then we will realize who and what we are in God. And at that moment, we will be lifted out of the darkness into the light. The Christ in us will come along. Like the mother of Zebedee, who had these two sons that she wanted, one on each side. Well, each of us have two sons. They are called the two thieves on our cross, the forces of good and evil, or the positive and the negative. The whole universe is like that, made up of these two forces. But it is up to the Father what happens with all of them, because he alone weaves the fabric of life. He alone knows the pattern. And we go about our business every day just butting our heads against a stone wall and berating ourselves, everybody else, and sometimes God, because things don't work out the way we want to. And we have to learn acceptance of God's will. We have to be still and know that I am, the great I am, or God within us, knows what he is doing. And no matter what we plan, if we are prevented from doing it, then we accept whatever comes as God's will. As Swami Ramdas told me one time, he said, "Make a skeleton plan, Mother, and let God fill in the details. But if God wants to change the skeleton plan, let him do that also." And every day of my life, I have been forced. I haven't always done it willingly, but I have been forced to do exactly that, because my life never goes exactly as I had planned. Overall, sure, it's all going toward God. Everything that I do, every thought, every word, every action, I want to be for God alone. And everything that I do that comes before me in a day, I try to make it that. But nevertheless, he is calling the shots, as it is said. And that is the truth. And so the way that I can make myself comfortable, at peace, and attain the greatest progress and do the greatest service for him is to put myself totally in his hands, to listen in the beginning for his voice of direction, which is your intuition. But after you have had the supreme experience, then it is the Christ consciousness which speaks through this form which he has made. In every single instance, there is no difference regardless of seeming appearance. But to the individual who has not attained that state, they will differentiate between the human and the divine. They will not be able to see that everything is God. That is most difficult. When you see people being slaughtered, being killed, fighting one with one another, hating one another, doing all of the things they do to one another. But the greatest crime is what you do to yourself. Because for everything that you do that is negative, unless you take a positive stand and follow through on it, you are punishing yourself. You are keeping yourself in hell. There is nobody else doing it to you. And you cannot make excuses of doing the same act day after day after day after day and saying, well, I'll keep on doing that, but as long as I keep my attention upon God, I'm going to get there anyway. It isn't going to work that way. You have to make an effort at overcoming. Now, true, by keeping your mind eternally upon God, that is good. But you, the human, have to make the necessary effort until such time as you come to the point where you know that of yourself you can do nothing. But to give in to all of your desires, to give in to the things that you know that will separate you from God, and to keep doing them day after day and day after day and expect to get your God realization, you will never get that pearl. Never. You've got to take a stand, and that's where the other saying of Jesus came in. And while they seem to conflict, they are the same thing. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. In other words, when evil comes at you, don't pay attention to it, but put your mind on God. But when you are tempted to do something which you know is against the purity of your body, your mind, and your soul, say, no, I shall not do that. And if your own will is not sufficient, then cry out to God with everything you've got in total and complete sincerity. God, I can't conquer this. Help me. And he will do that. He will do it with regard to any temptation in this world. I don't care what it is. It will happen. So start to clean the windows of your soul, but do it outwardly and inwardly. Because unless the windows are cleaned on both sides, you can't still see through them clearly. You're still looking at a glass or through a glass darkly, as it says in the scriptures. Your windows must be clean. But he who has cleaned the windows of his soul, both inside and outside, that one stands as a shining, a glorious, a radiant example to all mankind of what it means to sit on top of the mountain of your own being.